You are listening to WXRW LP Milwaukee, 104.1 FM, RiverWestRadio.com, globally, CreamCityMedia.com/anti. I'm your host, NTSC, and welcome to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society could look like while recognizing that none of us today are truly free. Long before I was born, long before any of us were born, many of us had something stolen from us. Whether or not that thing was of any value or importance to begin with is inconsequential. I'm not angry about its theft, but it happened, and it happened without my consent. Long before I was born, I had my culture, or any possible culture I might have had, stolen away from me and replaced with a descriptor I want nothing to do with. What nationality are you? What race are you? Are you an American? Are you black? Are you white? Are you Asian? Are you Latinx? Are you indigenous? What defines your culture? The food your grandmother cooked? The language your grandparents spoke at home? The celebrations you participate in annually? What is your culture? Long before my parents were even born, I had my culture, or any possible culture I might have had, stolen away from me and replaced with a descriptor I want nothing to do with. My culture was erased, removed, and replaced with whiteness. That's all I get to be now. Here in America, white. To try and be anything else now is to colonize, adopt, interpret, attempt, fake, corrupt, appropriate the culture of another. I don't get to have a culture beyond whiteness, and I want nothing to do with it, which sets me adrift into a cultureless void without tradition, without uniqueness. Beyond the traditions, at least, of genocide, torture, and global rape. That is the legacy of whiteness, and I want nothing to do with it. Now, technically, and I mean this in the most technical of technical senses, I'm a Polish American. But that's really meaningless. That's a joke. I don't speak Polish. The traditions of the American Polak are so far removed from those of a real Polish family as to be a laughable caricature. In fact, my values and beliefs personally are so far removed from those of your average Polish person as to be nearly opposite. No, I am not Polish. I am white. Whiteness is my heritage, the peculiar flavor of whiteness found here in America, to be specific, because it was the creation of America, and to a large extent, the institution of chattel slavery that led to the invention of whiteness, where it never existed before. In this week's episode, we'll be referencing a lot of work that was done by people way smarter than me, especially the work of Theodore W. Allen. To learn more about the creation of whiteness as a concept, a social class, and a power structure, I recommend his two-volume series, The Invention of the White Race. Way back in America's infancy, there was no such thing as being white. It would take decades for that concept to be solidified and codified for very pernicious reasons, namely as a method of social control and specifically in response to labor unrest, as a way to divide and conquer the working class of this country and eventually the world. To get started, let's listen to Director John A. Powell of the Haas Institute at UC Berkeley.
But in terms of our early stages, whiteness, as we understand it, race, as we understand it, didn't exist. And that may be hard to understand now because it's so prevalent. Everybody seems to have a race. But race actually came into being, and we can trace that being. And much of the formation of how we think about race came out of the New World, that is, when people came to the Americas from Europe. There were people from Africa, and there were people from Europe, and there were the elites. And, of course, there were the people who were already here, the native people. And the elites tried to organize the people from Africa, the workers from Europe, indentured servants, and the native people to actually control them, to extract resources from them. And at some point, the people from Africa and the people from Europe decided to make common cause. They lived together, they worked together, they intermarried, they had children. It wasn't perfect, but there probably was much more what we would call interracial contact then than there is now. And it didn't seem odd at all. And at some point, it occurred to them that, look, we're doing all the work. We have no control over our lives. So there's this rebellion called the Bacon Rebellion, where they rebelled against the elite. And they demanded land, and they demanded greater democracy. They demanded a right to participate in the governance of the colony. And the elites rejected that. And there's this rebellion. And the rebellion was quite successful, called the Bacon Rebellion. The elites responded by saying, look, we have too many workers, and if they work together in a common cause, it's going to be hard to manage them. So they tried to experiment with separating the Africans and Europeans. And it took them almost 100 years. They tried religion. They tried language. They tried place of origin. And they stumbled upon race. Now, they couldn't start with race because race didn't exist. So they couldn't just think of it. They had to experiment. And they start passing new laws, like anti-miscegenation laws. And they told the now newly minted whites that your role is to identify with the elites. You're not an elite yourself, but you should identify with the elites, and you should police the non-whites. And they create slave patrols. But also, they created a new identity, white identity. It had not existed before. And the white identity was that middle stratum, that stratum of identifying with the elites and controlling the non-whites. And it's important in terms of saying this that the elites didn't think of themselves as white. Yes, they were Europeans. What they thought of themselves were the elites. And because there had been this history where whites were so close to what was then blacks, there's always a fear that you might fall back into that space. So there's always this anxiety. An early definition of whites were defined in terms of not being black. It was a negative definition. Interesting, the Bacon Rebellion, Bacon himself was white, but it became known as a rebellion driven by blacks because they were trying to create a sense of blackness being scary and somehow a threat to whiteness. What's important in terms of this history is that whiteness itself never was the top dog. There was always the elites. So when we look at understanding race today in the economy, we sometimes think in terms of whites and non-whites, or whites and blacks, Latinos, others. And it has some currency, that's real. But missing from that formulation are the role of the elites. And the colonies, Virginia being the most important, was a corporation. So Virginia was literally owned by a corporation and governed by a corporation for the crown to extract as much resources as possible from people, from land. And to some extent, that formulation we still live with today, even though it's been updated.
In 1676, an alliance formed between European indentured servants and African indentured servants and slaves, as well as freed Africans, against Virginia Governor William Berkeley. The cruel institution of what was called bond servitude, which covered both indentured servitude and slavery, united these Europeans and Africans. They realized that they had more in common with each other than they did with the elite landowners. And as Director Powell said, we often forget that this country we began literally as colonies owned and operated by corporations acting on contracts awarded by various monarchies. And you may or may not know this, but the flag of the United States is the same flag flown by the East India Trading Company at the height of its power. They're nearly identical, 13 red and white stripes beside a blue field with, at the time, 13 stars arranged in a circle. The United States itself is nothing more than a continuation of the East India Trading Company, but that's a topic for another show. So these poor Europeans and the Africans with whom they worked and lived rebelled against the ruling elites, culminating in the burning of Jamestown. So the ruling class needed to figure out a way to divide and conquer, and had to literally invent the concept of race to achieve their ends. And we learned about the creation of slave patrols in our episode on the police called ACAB. Past episodes are available at creamcitymedia.com/anti. It was a devious invention that served the interests of the landowners for hundreds of years to come. So let's jump to the Civil War and beyond, and we'll get into the modern era. We're going to hear from anti-racism activist Timothy Jacob Wise on that score.
Fast forward to the Civil War era. You have rich white folks in the South, where I come from, standing up and openly admitting that the reason they're prepared to secede from the Union, and the only reason they ever articulated publicly, ever, was to maintain and extend slavery and white supremacy not only where it already existed, but into the newly acquired, that is to say, stolen territories from Mexico to the West. That was what they said. Now we lie about it. We say it wasn't about slavery, that it was about states' rights. Yes, the right of the states to keep and maintain slaves, exactly. They openly said it, but once again, the rich didn't want to go do the work. Are you kidding? No. They're going to get poor people to go fight for them. And the poor folks didn't even own slaves. Now think, how do you get poor people who don't even own the shirt on their back, let alone slaves, to go fight to keep your slaves for you? You've got to convince them that their skin is more important than their economic interest. Because think about it, if I am a farmer who has to charge you $1 a day or $2 a week to work on your farm and harvest that tobacco or pick that cotton, but you can get a black person to do it for free because you own them, who's going to get the job? Not me. In other words, slavery actually undermined the wages and the wage base, the economic floor of the typical white working class or low-income person. But they were told, if these people are freed, they're going to take your job. No, fool, they got your job. That's the point. And so at some level, again, working class white people being harmed by white privilege, relatively being advantaged, right? Being given a leg up, being given a membership to the club, but in absolute terms, being kept economically subordinated by the very thing that gave them a sense of superiority. How's that for irony? Now we have people running around insisting that we should close the border with Mexico because if we don't, the wages of working class people will continue to fall. The implication being that the only reason workers are paid like crap in this country is because the border is open. But if you believe that, you would actually have to believe that if that border were closed, that all these owners of capital and industry would just say, oh, well, you figured us out. Here, it's a raise. Do we really believe that the only thing keeping bosses from paying people more is the presence of low wage, medium, semi-skilled labor from south of this artificial border? Is that really what we believe? We know that if that border is closed, it isn't going to be closed to capital. It isn't going to be closed to goods. If you have a border that can be crossed by capital looking for the highest return on investment, or goods looking for the highest price, but labor is chained to its country of origin, how is that going to work to the benefit of working people? By definition, it doesn't. By definition, it immiserates the working class. Divide and conquer. But the best example of all, perhaps, in the contemporary era in the greater New Orleans area after Katrina. Here you have two communities that were the most hard hit. Lower Ninth Ward, mostly black community, 94% African American, about 40% official poverty rate, heavy working class community. And right across the canal, St. Bernard Parish, Chalmette, 95% white, also working class, high levels of poverty, economically very similar. And at the end of the day, in those first few days of September 2005, more similar than they probably would have realized. Because when those levees broke, they all got their stuff destroyed. But if you had asked white folks in Chalmette, and I've done it, who was the cause of the problems in the greater New Orleans area prior to that flooding, they would have pointed across that canal at those black folks, wouldn't have called them black folks, and would have said, there, that's the problem. 70% of the white folks in St. Bernard Parish voted for David Duke, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, former head of the largest Ku Klux Klan group in the United States when he ran for governor in 1991. 7 out of 10 gladly voted for him because he was blaming black folks for all of their problems, and they bought it. What's the irony? The irony is that while they were blaming black people for their problems, while they were blaming black people for the conditions of the greater New Orleans area in which they lived, nobody was paying attention, least of all they, to the fact that these white elite politicians, either in Baton Rouge or in Washington, whose job it was to secure those levees, to make sure that levee funds were spent in the proper way and that they were spent at all, those mostly white and mostly elite politicians did nothing. At the end of the day, it wasn't just the black folks in the lower Ninth Ward they didn't care about. They really couldn't have given a rat's ass about those poor and working class white folks either. And yet, when the people of Chalmette, people of St. Bernard Parish, got back into session, first time they had a city council meeting, parish council meeting after the flooding, the lights aren't even on yet. The water isn't even hooked up. And the first order of business was to pass an ordinance saying that you couldn't rent property in St. Bernard Parish to anyone who wasn't a blood relative. Now, I'll leave it to your imagination as to why you'd want to pass a law. That law had never existed before. But now that it's been emptied out and you don't know who might come back, that's a damn good way to keep black people out, isn't it? Because if you're 95% white to begin with, if you pass an ordinance that says that, that's a great way. You can't say no blacks need apply. You can't say no blacks allowed. But that was an ingenious way to get around the law. Now, they got caught. There was a lawsuit threatened and they got rid of the ordinance. But my point in bringing it up is to say, once again, divide and conquer is working. These white folks in Chalmette need to march across that canal and join hands with the black folks who've been sitting there more than willing to work with them for an awful long time, and march on Baton Rouge and march on DC and march on the Corps of Engineers and recognize their commonality of interest. But the whiteness and the lure of whiteness has tricked these have nothing in their bank account white people into believing that they got more in common with the rich white folks on St. Charles Avenue that didn't lose anything in that flooding than they have in common with the black working class folks who live about 500 yards away.
Let's take a little detour. It's the late 1840s into the early 1850s, and a fungus called Phytophthora infestans is wiping out the potato crop of Ireland. This shouldn't be an issue, except that Ireland was a colonial food exporting operation of the British Empire, kind of a colony on par with India and used primarily as a means to secure profit for the empire. Now, it should be noted, 80% of all food grown in Ireland was not, in fact, potatoes. It was corn, wheat, barley, oats, and other grains, along with many more kinds of food. And in truth, Ireland produced a vast food surplus. Now, mind you, the poor workers of Ireland could really only afford to buy cheap potatoes. So when the crop failed, they faced dire consequences. But the Irish implored the British government to close the ports and stop all the other edible foodstuffs from leaving the country. The government declined. The ports remained open, and millions of Irish peasants starved to death, even while they were forced to continue harvesting and shipping away good edible food to the mainland. Because remember, they were harvesting land that didn't belong to them, but instead belonged to the capitalists. And if they were to try and eat that good food that they were reaping, that would have been a crime. So they starved to death. Or, in vast droves, they fled to America. So what does this have to do with the invention of whiteness? Well, true to form, when a huge group of poor, disenfranchised immigrants flood into American shores, they were used by the wealthy elite as an easy scapegoat to point to as the cause of poor Americans' woes and hardships. To drive home the point, pseudoscience came out that declared that the Irish were, in fact, not white. Drawings of their skulls showed that they were more closely related to dogs than to white men. Now, that would all change with the conclusion of the Civil War. When new jobs became available to newly freed slaves, once again, the elites had their hated caste to blame. And so the Irish were deputized as white and given positions of power and authority over the newly freed blacks, with whom they had much more in common than the rich elites. They were no longer the hated Irish. They had become whites. Which leaves me and most other quote-unquote whites in America with no culture whatsoever, except that of the American culture. And the American culture is no culture of which to be proud. American history is no history in which to take any pride at all. The history of this country is one of genocide, rape, torture, murder, rampant, vicious destruction, deception, manipulation, and for what? All in the name of greed so inhuman and unbelievable so as to make me sick to my core. It makes me nauseous to face the brutality of this nation, and it continues unslowing to this present day. Let's look at the dictatorships, right, that our country so chastises. North Korea, Iran, Myanmar, and the list goes on. Our government would have us all believe that those dictatorships are the worst examples of criminally inhuman control. And I'm not here to defend totalitarianism. I'm an anarchist, right? However, the United States is absolutely without equal in the field of global terror. Yes, North Korea is absolutely clutched in the fist of a totalitarian oligarch. And as awful and horrific as the violence of that state regime probably is, it doesn't hold a candle to the violence perpetrated on the whole globe by the United States. Just in very recent history, to say nothing of the horrific crimes against humanity that this country perpetrated in the colonial period, Eisenhower installed a military dictatorship in Guatemala in the 50s. Before that, in 1948, George Kennan of the U.S. State Department was quoted as saying of America and its plans going forward, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity." So, to go back to Eisenhower's military coup in Guatemala, it was one of history's most tragic and brutal campaigns, and it was funded by the American government. Children were killed by being beaten against walls or thrown into deep pits. Limbs were amputated. People were burned alive with gasoline. Babies were literally cut out of pregnant women's wombs. That is the American culture. One of atrocity and murderous greed. Do you want any part of that? Eisenhower also overthrew Iran's democratically elected Mohammad Mossadegh because he stood in the way of British Petroleum's monopoly in the region. At the time, BP was called the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Cuba, 1959, American-backed Fulgencio Batista is overthrown by Fidel Castro, and the United States goes on a full-blown campaign of economic assassination against Cuba. 1964, Brazil, Lyndon Johnson overthrows democratically elected Joao Goulart because he passed a law that limited the amount of money multinational corporations could transmit out of the country. So the U.S. ambassador, Lincoln Gordon, under Johnson's orders, starts a military coup and installs a U.S.-friendly dictator famous for committing atrocities against the civilian population. 1973, Chile, Nixon overthrows democratically elected Salvador Allende and installs the dictator Augusto Pinochet, who famously oversaw the torture and murder of tens of thousands of Chileans.
One example famously being Victor Jara, a hero and folk musician whose hands were publicly chopped off for criticizing the Pinochet regime, and he would later be publicly executed. That blood is on America's hands collectively. 1984, Nicaragua. Reagan funds the Contras, a terrorist organization renowned for unthinkable violence. And then in El Salvador, Reagan funds a war against El Salvadoran rebels fighting their dictatorship to the tune of $4 billion American tax dollars. Reagan gives to put down that rebellion, with over 75,000 murders, most of which were directly committed by U.S.-backed forces, forces specifically trained by the United States. For example, are historically documented as raping and torturing whole villages before burning the entire population of them alive. That is the American culture, one of domination and inhuman brutality. Do you want anything to do with that? In the midst of the Cold War, the American agenda was clearly stated to maintain right-wing dictatorships in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia at all costs. The Khmer Rouge, perhaps history's most horrific entity, was directly caused by the actions of the United States, particularly the vicious bombing campaign waged against Cambodia. Civilian casualties will never be known, but Cambodian genocide scholar Ben Kiernan estimates the death toll to be between 50,000 and 150,000. Kiernan states, Pol Pot would never have won power without U.S. economic and military destabilization in Cambodia. That is the American legacy. Do you want any part of that? According to a British medical journal report, the civilian death toll caused by American intervention in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam totals higher than 5.4 million people, with a marginal error as high as 8.7 million. I use these horrible crimes committed on behalf of the American people as evidence of a culture I want nothing to do with. And yet, what other culture can I claim as my own? I'm not Polish. I'm agnostic, so I have no faith tradition to fall back on. All I've been given is the yoke of whiteness, a label that grants me very real privilege over marginalized minorities, and I want nothing to do with it. Yet it would be irresponsible for me to cast off that label, which I hate so much. Whiteness may be an invention of the ruling class, but it nonetheless exists now as a very real marker of privilege, along with my external cisgender maleness and my heteronormative lifestyle. And we'll have to examine the invention of heterosexuality in a later episode, but trust me, heterosexuality is just as invented as whiteness. I have to come to terms with the fact that I have no culture, and I can't have it. Any chance I had was taken away from me by rich Europeans hundreds of years ago. Instead, I must endeavor to use my created whiteness as a tool to further the cause of the working class, minorities, women, transgender people, neuroatypical people, and all other at-risk, disenfranchised populations, because I share more in common with them than I ever will with the ruling elite. Thank you for tuning into The Anti here on WXRW River West Radio. I've been your host, NTSC, and I'll be back again next week to discuss further topics as they relate to freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti, and more information about the show can be found on riverwestradio.com.